Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2017. Lecture 3, delivered on August 29, 2017. The title of this lecture is The Federal Reserve.
Today, special topic, the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is a central bank. The civilized world, the big nations have almost all have central banks. They started showing up in the 1800s. Actually, I shouldn't say that. The precursors of central banks started showing up in a few European countries in the 1600s. In other words, a bank that was the bank of the nation, that took care of the big business, the big topics of banking for the country. And we didn't get around to that until, what was it, 1913, I think, with the Federal Reserve Act. Here was the deal. History of the United States is oftentimes characterized by a lot of one thing or another, the exploration west or the industrialization. Know this, that in the early years, this first century and a half, first more than a century, the government was the best government money could buy. Quite honestly, most of the time, the politicians from both parties were chosen by, in these smoke-filled back rooms, by very overweight, fat, white men. And judges, everything from the judiciary to the legislature to the president, were essentially chosen politicians, and then they were put to the people. Once in a while, you had a rabble-rouser who was sort of like a populist, and they were allowed to be there just to give people something to feel like there was an alternative to the usual stuff. But for the most part, our politicians were bought and paid for. That's just the reality of it. They would give populist messages, but they would still pursue their own interests. And this goes clear back to the time of George Washington, who was had a bunch of cronies in various industries who made sure that he pursued their policies when necessary. The problem was, after the Civil War, okay, characterizing the pre-Civil War era, the industrialized North and the banks in New York and the shipping interests more or less controlled the flow of capital that was going on in the country. And it was concentrated, the power was concentrated in the hands of people who weren't exactly, in every case, the best people, the most ethical. By the time after the Civil War, the grip, the iron grip on the nation's finances of families in the North, in the New York area and all of that, had gotten pretty serious. You had a lot of players going crazy with scams and banks, and there were a couple of disasters in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, just absolute catastrophes. Look, here's how a bank works. You find $100, okay? Well, you see, what you can do is you can put it in my bank. Now, if I am an ethical kind of banker, if I'm a good banker, I'm going to keep some of that over here. Let's say $20. That way, if you come in and ask for some of your money, I've got some. Or if you write a check to him, he comes in, I can honor that check. But the rest I'm going to use to make some money. I'm a business. I got to make some money some way. So I'm going to use that other $80 maybe to lend you some money. So in a dollars in the bank, well, no, let me put it this way. available money. We start out with that $100. Now, I'm going to put $20 in reserve with a 20% reserve ratio. Okay, so there would be $20 that I would have for to honor things. And then from there, though, amount to invest. Where I can make money off. Now, my best way to invest as a bank would be to lend money. So you come to me, I've got $80 that I could invest. You come to me and you say, I need a loan because I've got a business idea. Well, that's great. I've got $80. Would that do? You say yes. So what I do is I lend you $80. But what happens is that that $80 shows back up in my bank because you paid this young woman and she deposits it in the bank. So I've got $80 more on my books. And so I keep 20% of that, which would be $16. And so now I have still $64 new money to put out. Well, you come to me with a business idea, and I say, well, I've got $64 to lend. So you say yes. So you borrow that $64 that I've got for investments, and you pay it to her to do some work for you, and you come to my bank and you put it in there. Look what's happening to the money supply. The money supply is growing without any new actual physical dollars existing. That is one of the fastest, most powerful ways that money grows in an economy, is through the banking system. The truth of the matter is that if I add all of these up, the total down at the bottom would finally come to be $500. How do I know that? Because the change in the money supply is going to be the initial amount of money, which in this case would be $100, times 1 over my reserve ratio, which in this case is 1 over 0.20. So that's how I got the $500. The money supply can grow on its own. But the problem is some bankers aren't going to keep that money. Keep $20. They're going to take risk. Sometimes they put hardly any in the back vault. They just lend the rest out. The problem comes if there is ever a time. Now, I'm being pretty conservative. A 20% reserve ratio is conservative. The problem comes, though, what happens if more than $20 is demanded from him? He comes in, asks for 15, but then he's written a check for 30 to you. He's written a check to you for 10. I don't have that money. There's nothing wrong. He's done nothing unethical. He's got $100 on deposit. He wants some, and he's written some checks, demand drafts. I don't have it. In a case like that, the bank fails. Right there, right then. This was what happened in a lot of banks in the late 1800s, the last half of the 19th century. There were what we call runs on banks. Sometimes the banks were just didn't keep money, and then when anyone came in, they fell apart. Other times, people panicked because they heard something bad about the bank or bad about the economy, and they ran in and tried to get their money, and it wasn't there, and the bank collapsed. We had this happening all the time, and then everyone loses. You lost your shirt. It's gone. That money's just gone. And you, who had done work demanding money, you don't get yours either. The whole thing just comes apart right there and then. The disaster is this. If my bank fails, you run a bank. You're keeping 20%, but everyone hears that bank failed. Everyone's going to rush your bank to get their money, and you won't have, even if you were keeping a decent amount on reserve, you're wiped out, you fold. Then it happens in a cascade across banks in a neighborhood or across banks in a region of a city, and you have a bank crisis. A fiasco happens. That was happening all over the place in the 1800s. People were losing money. I mean, these were working class people in those miserable factories. They were putting money away in their bank, and then all of a sudden the bank collapses. They got nothing. And then there was another trick that was really, really bad. And this went on even into the 20th century. I see your banks. You're very well-run banks, really good. You've got a bank. A couple of you've got banks. And I am a very powerful player. I own a newspaper or two or five or 50. I have connections to other media outlets, and I start a whisper. Did you hear that his bank is in trouble? No? Uh-huh. Yeah, his bank's in trouble. His bank's not in trouble. He's got reserves. But if I scare enough people, they'll run your bank, you'll collapse. And then a couple more banks will be run because they'll hear your depositors will hear your bank collapse. And by the time it's over, I just sit back and watch this happen. And then I come in and buy your banks at pennies on the dollar. I can create an artificial crisis. This was done over and over again. And it was done in the 1920s even, just to create runs on banks so that large, powerful families could gather up these banks and then consolidate control and create essentially monopoly conditions in the banking industry in city after city after city. So there you go. Now, truth be told, the only reason that this got to be a big problem was when banks of wealthy people started folding up. Banks of powerful people, banks of connected people. And then it was seen as one of those things that we have to address in Washington. And so finally, and we decided that we were going to need to do something that other countries had done long before us. We created a Federal Reserve System, a central bank, by the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. The Federal Reserve Act of 1913. It created a central bank, the Federal Reserve Bank, and it created a system over that called the Federal Reserve System. It's simple, it's basic. It just is a bank of the nation. It's not a bank that you can take your deposits to. That's not the kind of bank. It's an overbank. It's like an Uber bank or a Meta bank or something like that. Okay, they gave it three duties. One was that this bank would regulate and supervise other banks. It would regulate and supervise other banks, all the banks of the nation. And I'll get back to that in a minute. Its second job, too, was to serve as a bank for banks. In other words, banks have to deposit their money somewhere, so the Federal Reserve could be a place where they did that. But the rule was that this bank for banks had to act in a fair, competitive way with commercial banks that were private that did the same thing. So in other words, you have a bank. You can do your banking for your bank through either me, the Federal Reserve, or through this commercial. You're a private commercial bank that does the same thing. You get to choose which one you want to do. I'm not allowed, because I've got so much power as a huge thing in the government's agency, I'm not allowed to cheat and do unfair competitive prices against her. And I am charged with developing all kinds of new technologies constantly, and when I do, I have to just share them with you, no charge. That's how we got those checks, remember the ones with the magnetic strips? That was Federal Reserve, and then all banks adopted it, free of charge. ATM technologies, Federal Reserve. It does, here's the technology, now you use it too. So we compete. Someone asked me, they said, well, this was a couple of years ago, and I actually didn't know the answer at first. So, well, how many banks actually use the Federal Reserve, and how many banks use private commercial banks? I didn't know, so I called some contacts I have at the Federal Reserve in St. Louis, and the fellow I know there said, well, actually, in the St. Louis district, 65% of the bank, I think he said 65% of the banks use the Fed and 35% use private commercial banks. There's healthy competition. In other words, this is a model which is, this is a model where you can have the government run a business, but under the rules, it has to be fair in its competition with private businesses, and both can survive quite well. Go.
After the crash of 08, did you know, was there a shift toward more banks using the Fed rather than using private commercial?
The answer to that is yes. The reason being that that and the Fed was offering candy. I mean, so much candy. And it didn't shift terribly, but oddly enough, both the Fed and these banks that are private commercial make lots of money doing this. The Fed, every year, turns over the money it makes to the Treasury. We're talking billions of dollars. It makes that it just turns over to the banks. Now, you're a private bank. That's your shareholders' money. There is an incentive for banks like hers, even in a crisis. Okay, we're losing business to the big dog. We're going to have to get more competitive. So in a way, it actually tightened the competition. Fees for banking services went down, and services have actually increased. The big thing right now, the big thing is security. We know that the hackers have gotten in. We know that the problem is scary. And that's why you've seen this new chip technology. You have to put your card in and then just leave it there and all that kind of stuff. So this is the forerunner in this is still the Federal Reserve, and it shares this, which helps to keep you from losing business to me. I can't do things that would intentionally hurt you, a private business. The interesting thing about this is back during the night in 2009, there was a big war over a new kind of healthcare system, health insurance. It came out with the Affordable Care Act, which admittedly has some really big flaws in it. I and a few other economists were trying to say to these politicians, why don't you do it like the Federal Reserve does it? You have a health insurance system provided by the government in direct competition with private health insurers, but the rules are like the Fed's rules. You can't do things that are cheating and to hurt your competition. We know very well that this works, and these private commercial banks are hugely profitable. Can't we do that here so we have the same model instead of going with completely socialized healthcare or some free market that's hurting too many people? Why can't we find this middle ground? No one wanted to hear that. Gee, we've been doing this for almost a century and it works. Why don't we do it with another big thing that needs some kind of intervention in a free market? No one wanted to listen to it, so we got the Affordable Care Act, and as decent, it's a try, but it's still, you know, one way or the other, it's got its flaws that are pulled apart by interests that don't like it. Now, the third is that the Federal Reserve conducts monetary policy. This is a fancy way of saying that the Fed controls the money supply. The Fed controls the money supply. That's all it is. By the way, I'm going to put up a video that is made by the Federal Reserve, the St. Louis Fed. It's a cartoon video. It covers this. It's really cheesy, but it actually covers the basics of what I'm telling you here. So if you're getting behind your notes as I talk fast, don't sweat it. I'm going to put up the link to that Fed video. It's called In Plain English. The St. Louis Fed does all kinds of education outreach, a lot of stuff like that. They've got games, simulations. They've got a huge facility you can use for your research called FRED, the Federal Reserve Economic Database. You can get data vectors of all kinds. So anyway, conducts monetary policy. It controls the money supply. Those are its three jobs. Now, the way the Fed was set up, it is overseen by a board of governors. These are Seven people. One of them is the chairman. Don't let me fool you on the test by saying the Federal Reserve Board of Governors is seven governors plus one chairman. No, the chairman is one of the seven. These are appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. They, historically, they have been the cream of the crop in business, banking, economics, finance, accounting. They are the, I've met two of them in my life. Now, some of them are controversial. Some of them started out great and got really bad as the years went on. There was a classic example of that, Alan Greenspan. He was actually a remarkably good chairman until he got toward his last years, and then he just got really nasty. The one after him was Ben Bernanke, who was kind of like, I don't know, he had all the excitement of oatmeal. And now we've got Janet Yellen. She's a pretty strong voice. She's pretty strong-willed and probably a little too afraid to do what might have to be done. Yeah, so the next chairman is going to be left with that job. Okay, the seven board of governors. They are the regulators. They take banking law and turn it into regulations that banks can follow. That's how law works. You don't just write a law and say, everyone obey, especially in business. Business law is written, and then there is some kind of a commission or an agency or something like that that takes those laws and writes the regulations that businesses can use to abide by the law. So in other words, the Board of Governors regulates, it interprets, and then promulgates what should be done. Now, underneath the Board of Governors, the country is divided into 12 districts. And each of those has a bank president. These districts, each in its own district, supervises the banks in the district. I've met three bank presidents. They are, again, cream of the crop. And they actually serve. Sometimes they'll go to become a board of one of the governors. And among these are one for a special committee called the Federal Open Market Committee. Five of these district banks work with the governors in a committee that controls the money supply. These 12 district bank presidents are absolutely consummate business, banking, politicians, everything about them is just perfect. They've never had a traffic ticket. I don't think they've ever even had sex. I've never asked them. I mean, you have to be diplomatic. But the odd thing was, when this whole thing was created at the beginning of the 20th century, all of the population, the big population, was out east. So the districts out east are real small geographically. The districts out west are huge. Well, as time went on, the west became fully populated. And now you've got the San Francisco branch, which has to oversee this vast territory of banks. It's kind of ridiculous how it's laid out, and there's no way we'll ever change it. Now, there are 12 of these districts. Here, where we are, we're right near the border of two districts, the one up in Chicago and the one down in St. Louis. Now, the one, do you know which one we're in? We are actually, say it? Yeah, just actually, I think it's like only about 40 miles north, south of here is the St. Louis district. Now, I took my students down to the St. Louis Fed. They're the ones who are real into education and all this kind of stuff. I took my club students down there about about 3 years ago. They really put on a show for us. They were really nice, and they had some of the top economists and banking and finance people. They really wanted to recruit students for things like for their economic analysis. They pay, if you work for the Fed, they'll pay for the rest of your education, clear through your PhD, all that kind of stuff. They really put on a show, and of course my students, almost all of them said, no, I want to move back to Chicago. And so I took my students into the Chicago Fed. They got all the Feds have this little display a big display room where you can go and look at $1 million and see shredded money and all that. So I took the students up to the Chicago one. It's always been not a friendly place for that kind of thing. I took my students in there, and we all had to crowd into this one room and waited for them for this enormous security guard. She just stood there staring at us all, and finally she decided she'd make us go in a single-file line. I'm clear at the back of the line as the students go into this museum area or whatever it is. And as soon as my students got in there, and then I started walking, and she hits me over the hand with her baton. You know, ow, you ham beast! That hurt! It turned out great lady, had drinks with her. But anyway... Not the open, we want to show you what we do that you get down at the St. Louis Fed. Although this year I'll probably take my business club students up to the Chicago Fed, see if I can get them to be a little less uptight about having to talk to human beings in there. Look, the system... Let me talk about this. First of all, I got to go through something, and you probably did this in your econ class, but you might have forgotten it. You might have not have had it taught well. Most definitely, you didn't have it taught by someone as good as I am. Money. First things first. Madam, what is money? Kind of a blind question. You know what it is, but how do you explain it? Would you like to try, or you want to pass on it? Okay, sir.
It's printed tender used for debts, public and private.
That's one kind of money. Let's try this. You and I are cavemen. Okay, now cavemen don't have money. I mean, I walk into a bank. Want money. I don't know. It depends on the bank. You know, some of these banks, the credit unions, will take anybody. So I would say I'm going in there as a zombie. You know, anyway, okay. Now, you hunt moose. You have killed a moose. You have it over your shoulder like this. And, you know, you're doing like this so the antlers scratch your back. That's really cool. Yeah, get some of the hair off. And so... You come to my door. You come to my cave. I make apple pies. And you knock on my cave and you say, I have moose. And I say, well, I have pie. What did you say your name was? Dean Winchester. I like pie. Okay, you don't know that. It's supernatural. But anyway. Okay. Listen, I give you moose for pies. Okay, I will give you two pies for one moose. And you say, no deal. This moose, good back scratcher, plenty of meat, fur, you can give it to your lady. Okay, I know, right? You know, you want to talk romance? Moose, smell good. Okay. So you say, I want four pies. I say, deal. You drive a hard bargain. Okay, so we've traded a moose for pies. Now, you, madam, come to me later and you've got an elk. I want pies for elk. I say, okay, we do a deal. Over a period of time, I collect a lot of meat and then I open a butcher shop for higher class cave people. And the bottom line is that you understand that those pies are generally accepted in trade for other things. They are money. Money is any asset that is generally accepted in trade for other assets. Anything could be money if it's generally accepted, or at least widely or commonly accepted. Money does not have to be something, well, it doesn't even have to be physical. The first kind of money is the money that I was just talking about, barter money. Barter money has a special characteristic. Its intrinsic value is worth as much as its value in trade. Those pies had intrinsic value. You could fully eat them. You could eat every part of them. You could the crust. I mean, I make a crust like you wouldn't believe. I mean, flaky. You can eat that. You can't eat the pan. I mean, I just bought those pans at Cavemen R Us. It was ceramic, and you know, it stands up to the pit fire. You know. But barter money is a special kind of money, and it is actually, historically, it is the most common kind of money all through history. The idea that people in ancient times or even in medieval times had money. You'll see in some movie they're at a medieval bar and they'll trade a coin for a drink. No, that was very unusual. Only the wealthier people and the merchant class generally had money. Back in ancient times, there's a famous sort of like a kind of an amazing thing. The ancient Egyptians kept incredibly detailed records of everything, of their commerce, of their wars. Win or lose, the scribes were blunt and very, very glib about, well, we got our butts kicked in that battle, and or, well, we had this economic downturn. And there were they quite glib about some of the pharaohs building those pyramids and the incredible economic stress it created on the people of the empire. But there's a story that was written by the scribes where one of the pharaohs was having his pyramids built. Now, the way the pyramids were built, we think about slaves and whips and all that. No, that's not how pyramids were built. They were built by trained professionals. There were the scribes, there were the architects, the engineers, there were the teams that built, did the physical labor. As a matter of fact, you go into the inner chambers of the pyramids, you'll see the logos of the teams of builders. When they finished it, they put their logo. We did this. I mean, it was a kind of an awesome, incredible, the management, if we could understand the how they arranged their factors of production. Those were big, big projects. But anyway, story goes that when one pyramid, the professionals were not paid in money. They were paid in food and drink and in, forgive me for this, and in women. But turned out that the professionals were saying, we're not paying us enough, Pharaoh. You're screwing us. We don't like what you're doing. So we're going to stop working on these pyramids until you pay us. And again, no money in the sense that you would think of it. It was barter money. And they went on strike. Actually, it's the first documented labor strike in recorded history for more barter money. Well, there was the discussions in the pharaoh's inner circle went something like this. Okay, this is ridiculous. This is Pharaoh. This is a god on earth. How dare them do this? Let's go in and kill them. Or let's do better. Let's just kill a tenth of them. Let's decimate them to teach them a lesson. And then there was this, the wiser head said, think about how that works. We're going to kill a tenth of the scribes that write the letters that tell the dead pharaoh how to go to his heaven. Okay, so let's kill 10% of them and see how the scribes describe where he goes when he in the afterlife. They'll send him to some place that's really bad, like the sewer system outside of town. Oops, well, our bad. You killed some of ours, so we sent you to a toilet for the rest of eternity. Literally, it was going like that, literally in the wording. And so they actually buckled. The Pharaoh said, fine, whatever, just give them what they want. And so they got more food, more wine, and more entertainment. So there you are, barter money in its purest form, where you can consume every bit of the money, was very common, even into modern times. I mean, we all do barter money. Even to this day, barter is still. I mean, I'll trade a can of Spam for something like, I don't know, a cup of coffee. Two, the next one you can use two terms. It's commodity or metal money. Commodity or metal. Now, this money has some intrinsic value, but it does not have full intrinsic value. Gold would be an example. Gold does have intrinsic value, or you can use it in trade, like in coins. It has shown up quite a bit through history. Silver, gold, other metals. Metal monies, there are interesting stories. At times of great stress in warfare situations, you will find from that period arrowheads and spearheads that have the odd thing that they have inscriptions kind of in them, kind of bashed in. What they would do is they would take the money, the coins of the time, and they would hammer them and turn them into weapons. They would weaponize the money. And so there you have a good example of that use. Metal can be used on its own, or it can be used as a means of trade and a store of value, of course. Now, this third one is what is called fiat money. Fiat money or fiat money. I used to pronounce it fiat, but I had some hoity-toities tell me you pronounce it fiat. Fiat money is money that has value only by decree of a sovereign. In other words, a dollar bill, a dollar bill really has only a tiny amount of value. It does have some. You could use this to light a cigar for, blow your nose, something like that. So it does have a little bit of use. It has a little intrinsic value. But primarily, it is only because, as you said, the government orders us to accept it in trade. That's the only reason it is traded. If I didn't know what this was, and someone said, here, I'm going to give you this for my pie, I'd say, get away from me with that. What am I supposed to use that for? I got Charmin. Okay? Some of you caught that. Okay. And finally, the one that's not in the books now. It hasn't even, I don't think it's showing up in any textbooks yet. It's kind of funny, too, are the cryptos, the cryptocurrencies. A cryptocurrency has absolutely zero intrinsic value. Zero. It has none whatsoever. It has no physical existence. It is only a bunch of electrons getting together to have fun. That's all it is. And this is the one where you will live your life. You see, you're always going to, these are all, whenever technology changes, it doesn't abandon the old one. It stacks a new one and prefers it over the old one, but the old one doesn't vanish. Metals came in after barter, but barter still exists. Fiat came in after metals, but metals and barter still exist. The cryptos are now coming in, and that does not mean that they will replace these. They will just become the dominant currency over the next 3 to 4 decades. It'll take a while. It'll pick up speed. I'm guessing that probably by your mid-30s, you will be transacting at least sometimes in bitcoins or some advanced evolution of them. Some of you will actually be paid in Bitcoin. There are some companies that actually, they give you a choice. You want to be paid in money, in fiat money, or do you want to be paid in crypto? So it's coming. Like I said, though, it will not wipe out the other ones. We haven't seen that historically ever. It'll just be another one in the whole chain. So if I ask you on an exam, list and explain, hint, hint, list and explain the types of money, this is what I'm referring to, the kinds of money. Or I might ask you, what is money? That's a gimme if you answer what I told you. Don't be a fighter pilot. Don't look online. Look at your notes and answer what I've told you. Okay? Kind of weird. It's actually kind of cool. 20 years ago, I would have taught this, and there would have been no concept of a crypto. Now, there were some crypto experiments going on. There was one company, I think it was Apple, they were trying to have a cryptocurrency for transactions on Apple products, I think. It was called the Apple Purse or something like that. It fell apart right away. Not because it was problematic, but because people just couldn't accept it. They couldn't get their minds around that concept. They were afraid of this thing coming. Great deal of fear oftentimes comes with any kind of new technology. The first thing I can guarantee you is that a government will try to over-regulate it. They'll try, maybe even try to stop it. That's what they've been doing with Bitcoin to some extent, because it can be used for any transaction anonymously. So you could buy yourself a meal with Bitcoin, or you could buy yourself something very unusual as far as chemical combinations go with it. You go on the dark web, and I'll talk about this later. Into the dark web is a very, very rough world. Some awful, horrible things. But on the Silk Road, which was busted, but now that doesn't mean anything. You can't kill off a hydra like that. On Silk Road, you can buy about anything. And it was all anonymous, and that's one of the powers of cryptos. Purely, completely anonymous. Go.
So do you think that in the 2030s when we're using a lot of Bitcoin, that there won't be euros or dollars?
Oh, no, there still will, sure. Like I said, they never replace. Historically, we've never seen an advance in monetary technology wipe out a previous one. All we see is that it becomes the favored one. Sometimes only in certain environments does it become the favored one. Also, we see, interestingly enough, an ebb and a flow. In bad economic times, we know that people stop transacting in fiats and metals, and they start bartering for goods and services with each other. In war zones, we see fiats disappear. Metals are still there, and barter is there. So we see an ebb and a flow through time. So crypto will join an ecosystem of currencies. It will come to be the favored one for certain types of transactions and in certain types of economic times. But then it will ebb backward to one of the other ones in different times and under different transactional circumstances. That's the way we use it. Go. Theoretically, now I really hate it when people ask me questions like this, because theoretically, because the credit card is denominated, everything happens in dollars, and you could go and get the dollars. You could take your debit card to the ATM and get physical money out of it. It is technically just an efficient fiat. I can't say no to your debit card unless, you know, under certain circumstances. But if it's in dollars and denominated in dollars, you see, that's the interesting thing, is that because the fiat is by decree of the sovereign, I can turn anything you have into dollars as far as a debit card goes, or a credit card. It has a dollar value. Now, you'll see Bitcoin quoted in dollars. But if you're really into Bitcoin, you don't do that. Yeah, we just don't do it. Technically, I don't know that it would be very easy. There are ATMs that will, if you've got a Bitcoin purse, you can turn them into dollars, but it's not common. And most people who work in crypto wouldn't even think of turning it into dollars. It's a currency. Why would I turn it into another currency unless I had some absolutely compelling excuse to do so? So your question is valid. Essentially, you're saying, well, debit cards are all electronic money, but it does immediately convert back into the fiat money. Technically, you could turn it into any of these, too, right away. And the crypto will fall into that to some extent, too. But, okay, now, I'm going to take you on another. Now, how monetary policy is conducted? this is a pain in the butt thing, but I want to show you something at the end that of this lecture that I need to bring this up. How the Fed does monetary policy. It generally has three ways that it could do that. But first I'm going to define monetary aggregates. The first monetary aggregate is M0, one that you oftentimes will never hear about. M0, this is the base currency, the cash and currency in the economy. It doesn't include anything but the coins and the bills. That's all it does. It's one that you don't see quoted very often. But I'm one of those financial economists who does watch it because it worries me when you see base currency contracting or expanding, because that says something about people's concerns for or confidence in the economy. It's just coins and currency. The one you usually see quoted first is the monetary aggregate M1. M1 is M0 plus demand deposits at banks. And strangely enough, another thing that is hardly used anymore at all, but it is highly, highly liquid, are traveler's checks. And that's spelled with two L's because it's a European thing. Have any of you ever used traveler's checks? They used to be very popular. You don't leave home without them. They can be turned into cash instantly anywhere in the world, lost or stolen. They were real popular in the past, but they kind of have faded. I don't hear too many people getting traveler's checks to go overseas these days. But these, now, I said the word liquid. Liquidity is the efficiency with which one asset can be converted into another. Liquidity is the efficiency with which one asset can be converted into another. Efficiency means it's very low cost to do it, and also it's fast to do it. So in other words, now a lot of people refer to liquidity, how fast can I turn it into cash? But that's actually not the best definition of liquidity. It's just how fast one asset can be converted into another. So in other words, this fiat money, this $1 bill, is highly, highly liquid. It's an M0 and it's an M1. This thing, I can turn this into a hamburger at McDonald's within seconds. Highly liquid. On the other hand, you, madam, are an asset, but you are very illiquid. Because, well, you know, you'd be all over the floor. But you know what I mean. Concentrate, woman. It's like this. Look, you are going to create a lot of value over your life. You're going to earn a large income that will grow, your intellectual capacity will develop, skill sets will, and you'll be highly productive. You are a very valuable asset. However, I can't turn you into money right now. I can't take you up to that McDonald's and say, here, I want a burger. Well, for one thing, you'd be fussing, and you know, what are you doing? You know, getting you through the drive-through window for the cashier. You know what I mean. But the point is that there's an asset, but it's not liquid at all. You, sir, own a house. Are you really going to go to the grocery store and trade that house for some groceries? I think not. Milk's on sale this week, by the way. Okay. You see, assets. For example, stocks are not liquid assets at all. Really. Well, although Any more, you can trade them very quickly if they are very high quality stocks. The same is true like CDs, certificates of deposit. You put your money in there and there's a substantial interest penalty for early withdrawal. In other words, you put it into an investment like that, it becomes very illiquid over a period of time. So as I'm going down this list, what you're seeing here is a progression toward illiquidity. The next kind of money is M2. M2 is M1 plus some time deposits, like some CDs up to a couple of million dollars. In other words, this M2 is labored with things in it that are very large amounts of money, chunks of money, and they're not easily traded in a short amount of time. And then finally, M3. Which is M2 plus huge time deposits and the big one, euro dollars. Now, a euro dollar, despite being called euro, all that means is that that is American money in central banks of other countries. That's American money in central banks of other countries. Following with me? Okay. Now, here's the thing. You look, you're a Chinese merchant. You make Chinese toasters. Okay, I am an American consumer. I want to buy one of your Chinese toasters. So you charge me, let's say, $5 for it. I buy it at Walmart. You're never going to see $5, ever. What will happen is the transaction will go through the People's Bank of China, their central bank. You will take the $5 and pay him the equivalent in his currency. The yuan, okay? You are collecting 5 euro dollars. Every time we buy something from another country, the central bank of that country gets the money and it accumulates their foreign reserves, euro dollars, okay? They are highly illiquid. So in other words, actually there are two transactions going on in any international sale. There is one, a toaster coming to me, and there is two, money, my money, going to the central bank of that country where it was produced. That's how it works. As we import more and more and more, what's happening is that the euro dollar supply is going up and up and up. Okay? They collect our money. When we buy oil from overseas, those are euro dollars accumulating in the banks of the exporting countries. When you buy French wine, Chateau Neuf de Derrière or something like that, I don't know. And so what you do is when you buy that wine, when I buy a French wine, or you buy a French wine, you are paying the French Central Bank. But if you like American products, so you buy something from the United States, that would mean that euros, the French currency, would accumulate in our central bank. So the euro dollars are highly illiquid. By the way, what do they do with all those dollars that they collect? You can't spend a country's money anywhere but in that country. So over a period of time, the People's Bank of China can do nothing with those American dollars in its foreign reserves except invest them back here in long-term assets. That's how we've had all the money to have all of these government programs, theater wars, some welfare programs, all of this stuff. We had low taxes, we couldn't pay for it, but they had all these euro dollars in China and other countries, and they lent us the money. They did our stock offerings, our bond offerings of large corporations, and all of that, because we buy so much from overseas at low prices that they have accumulated all of these euro dollars that they have to spend back here. So they do, by letting us live beyond our means without any idea that every time we borrow from them, we are actually committing to long-term cash outflows to pay them back. That's how it works. Okay, so here are the three types of money. Now, the Federal Reserve is in the business of controlling the money supply. If you let the money supply grow too quickly, if the money supply growth rate exceeds the growth rate of the economy, we will have inflation. If the growth rate of the money supply is less than the growth rate of the economy, then we will have deflation. Know this. You might have heard, well, those unions are going to have a wage increase, that'll create inflation. Or those companies raise their prices, that's inflation. No, it's not. There is only one way that actual full economy inflation can happen, and that's if the growth rate of the money supply exceeds the growth rate of the economy. The Fed's job was to try to keep the growth rate of the money supply on track with the growth rate of the economy. That was its goal, to prevent inflations and deflations. Unfortunately, the Fed, over time, it would want to help the economy by printing money to help the economy in the short run. Eventually, that creates inflation. And then it would claw the money back in, and then we'd have a crash. But the job of the Fed was supposed to be to not let that happen. Now, I'm going to show you something here to finish this. And try to see what if you notice it. ISU.prof.com/docs/M1M2M3-2000.png. There it is. The Federal Reserve provides data. Now look here. The Federal Reserve actually stopped reporting M3. This is from Shadow Government Statistics. Do you see how this was skyrocketing? From the about 2003, it was just roaring upward. That was us just buying cheap overseas stuff. Now, the interesting thing here is, look what was happening to the base M1, the money that you and businesses use. Do you see how the Federal Reserve had cut its growth rate to zero? They were trying to control M3 by controlling M1. That was one of the primary reasons that the economy buckled, because it was essentially the lubrication of the economy was drying up. And by the middle of 2008, the economy just didn't have enough money anymore. Some people ask me, well, what's this giant spike over here? Oh, that was just 9/11. When they were afraid that the banks, people were going to run the banks, so they had trucks just racing out to get to the banks' money. Turned out people didn't panic, and so about 6 months later, they pulled that money back out of the banks. But there's a little curious thing, a little story in here. September 11th, 2001. See the spike? This is in July. Why was the Fed pouring insane amounts of money into the banks before the attack happened? Do you see it? Do you see the spike? That spike didn't happen in one day. That spike had been going on for several months before the attack. That's all I have for you. I thank you.